And it's really important to remember, whatever anybody may think during the evening, that homeless people are Americans. And this is a show about America. And it's not just about homeless people. It's a show about the kind of country that we are. People from the dawn of time that we know anything about anyway. You know, when they made war, people who believed in God, and I certainly respect those who don't, but people who believed in God believed that when you went to war, you had to be right with God. And people who might be atheists or have some other persuasion might certainly think that just common sense says that when a country is being challenged and a country is threatened, it's a time for everyone to be pulling together. So I would say that at the very least, we need to recognize that, are we a country that is going to pull together? And pulling together means pulling all of us together, including the people who are sleeping in the streets. And it's my profound belief that when we take care of all our people, we'll be in much better shape as a nation to make war or to make peace or to meet whatever challenge lies ahead.
A lot of times there's a lot of, like I say, criteria, regulations, limits, and everything for you to, you have to practically be on your feet, it seems, to get some funding. They want you to do some of the work before they actually help you, and yet it's really hard to get some things done when you don't have to, you don't have any funds to get around and do it, or to get out there and get some kind of education or some kind of shelter when you got all of these things on your mind. Like my husband said, it gets really depressed, and a lot of times when you get depressed, I'm sure a lot of people know, you can't just get up and go. You have to force yourself even to do that. So a lot of the organizations that have the upper hand to say who gets the money and who doesn't realize that it's a really depressing situation for like me, you know, coming here to the city and thinking that there's all these opportunities and realizing that, you know, there isn't. At one time I believed, you know, that maybe there was, you know, in order to be homeless, you put yourself out there to be homeless, but that isn't true. You know, now that I realize it, it's the system, it's the society that stops you from actually getting any kind of funding. The people are trying their hardest to walk on a path that's led for them, and then there's all these things that prevent them from it.
Have your children shown any acting out or any kinds of emotional reaction to the situation that you're in?
Oh, very much so. I believe it's affected our children as much as it's affected us. It's very hard on children, and I believe it might be even harder on them than it is on us adults, because they don't understand what's going on. They don't understand why they don't have the things they used to have. A lot of times when we're on the street, they didn't understand why they couldn't sleep in their own beds or why they couldn't eat, you know, when they were hungry.
And you actually had nights when the kids were not fed?
Yes.
And have you tried things like begging on the streets for money and stuff when you've had this situation?
Well, we've done a lot of calling agencies, trying to get help. Every day I was looking for a phone to go and call agencies. I called every agency in Portland every day. And it got to the point where they knew who we were the moment I called. So, but they weren't able to help.
Because the resources just aren't there.
Yeah.
Well, how are you going to get into it? You are going to get assistance with the housing. They say eventually they're going to try and get you into permanent housing. Is the city of Portland going to give you the first and last month or whatever you need to get into transitional or get into permanent housing?
I don't believe so. So that is something that we're trying to save up money right now. Right now, like I said, we haven't even gotten our first check from my husband's job. Mm-hmm. And so, but we are planning on doing that. Portland Impact is helping us to budget our money so that we have a savings.
Portland Impact is an assistance group here.
Yes.
A nonprofit group, not a governmental group, correct?
Right.
Yeah. And they're helping you to budget money and helping you to find resources and so forth?
Yes.
But there's just nobody coming forward, even at this late date, with helping you with the security deposit for housing or anything, as we speak today.
No, actually, there are a lot of agencies out there that do that, but they're all tapped out. They have no money left, and they are also sympathetic towards wanting to help us and not being able to.
We've just got seconds. What have you learned out on the streets?
A lot of people out there are really, really friendly people. A lot of them are willing to give you what they got, even though it's their last item, and they're willing to share with you.
Do we have any sense of how many homeless people are dying on the streets?
The bottom line is the answer is no, just like we don't know how many homeless people who are alive today, because it's impossible to count all the homeless people in America. We actually don't have a good scientific number as to the numbers, but every December 21st for the last 12 years, the National Coalition has been sponsoring National Homeless Persons Memorial Day. And this past December, 100 different cities did events to remember those people who died homeless in their communities. But what we do know from some of the cities, here in the nation's capital, 33 people died last year, died homeless. In San Francisco, 75, Denver, 67, Santa Cruz, 29, Brunswick, Maine, 11, in the Boston area for eastern Massachusetts, 202 people died, including 66 homeless veterans. So there's a lot of people who are living homeless in this country, and there's a lot of people who are dying homeless. And we have found that the leading cause of death among homeless people is natural causes, which only makes sense. If you're born poor, you die poor. The second leading cause of death among homeless people is murder, and the third is suicide, and fourth is hypothermia. Here in Washington, D.C., we've already lost two people since Christmas Day here in Washington, D.C. So it is a major epidemic, and the numbers, like in the past 12 years in Boston, 1,300 homeless people overall have died homeless, either on the streets or in the shelters. So it is a major, major problem.
Now, when you say natural causes, though, you're lumping that in with people who, or are you lumping that together with people who have medical conditions, which if they were treated and they had access to better care and a better place to recuperate, they might not have died of?
Right. Yes, I'm lumping people who have medical problems who would, if they did receive treatment, they would not be dying of natural causes. Mm-hmm. Then the other deaths that we've been tracking over the last 2 years have been hate crimes and violence against homeless people. In 2000, and we're now just working on our 2001 report, but in the year 2000, 43 homeless people were murdered in this country by non-homeless people, and for the most part, the perpetrators were teenagers and young adults, and it happened in 42 different cities around the country. The average age of the homeless victims were from 19 years of age to 72, and around 60 were male and 5 were female.
But these are just pure hate crimes. They just say, let's go out and get some one of these homeless bums, and they attack somebody. It's not...
For the most part, I think why not all the murders are necessarily a hate crime, but because where people are sitting in their kitchen table, let's go out and set fire to a homeless person. But the fact that homeless people have to live outside, living outside is a dangerous thing to do in this country, no matter where you are. And I think that's why homeless people are more susceptible to hate crimes and violence compared to the general population.
They're easier to find, obviously, but is setting people on fire really something that goes on?
Yes, in the early 1980s, you would occasionally hear of a person being set on fire, either in some of the big cities on the west or the east coast. But today, I would estimate in the last 2 years there have been 10 people each year set on fire by young people. So it is a major problem.
Statistics have shown and research has shown that the birth rate among women on welfare is actually much lower than the general population. And really, it's having a child is not an incentive to stay on welfare. You get such a small amount of money, if you get any money at all, when you have a child on public assistance. It's a myth. It's what I call an urban legend.
If what women who are on welfare, temporarily on welfare, need is not a good swift kick in the pants, what is it that they do need?
Well, thank you for asking, because I have a laundry list of items. I would have to say the very first thing, they need to have access to the services. We've put up barriers to people. People that already have severe barriers in their own life, such as learning disabilities, mental health, physical health issues, domestic violence, they are also finding barriers when they go to ask for help. We don't allow them. They're turned away, saying, "I'm sorry, you're not eligible." They're not even given the opportunity to apply. So we need to open the doors and allow people access to the services. In addition to that, the monthly grant levels are incredibly low. In no state in the country does the monthly TANF allotment bring anyone even close to the federal poverty level.
Let me just interject. TANF stands for Temporary Assistance for Needy Families.
Yes,
that's the
yes.
replacement for aid
for
to families with dependent children, which was a more long-term program. Now
Correct.
It's gone. Okay.
Right. So we're basically subjecting them to live at a sub-poverty level existence and then tell them to get up off their lazy behinds and find a job while they're struggling to put food on the table.
Mm-hmm.
But while they're out there looking for work, they're doing so with very limited skills.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not allowing them access to post-secondary education. And, in fact, some states don't even allow them to go look for education at all, whether it be vocational or whatnot. There's absolutely nothing available to them. And education has been shown to be the clearest way to lift families out of poverty.
When do we start holding people accountable for either their actions or their neglect of their services? And I'm talking primarily I'm talking about social services that gets that immunity clause, that immunity standard, that they're where they can fail their client and then claim immunity. It doesn't matter. The society is going to pay for all that damage, and that's a bunch of crap.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that people really, really ought to start addressing this here matter, that even social workers need to be brought to a higher standard of accountability, no less different than fire department, police department, and anybody. Everybody needs to be held accountable. You cannot go out there and hold a gun in your hand and recklessly shoot it off and say you're a civil servant and claim immunity from your actions. Neither can social workers go out there and wrench families apart and say, "Oh, it was a mistake."
And right now, I've been working for a couple of years to try to get a homeless legal campground where
good,
we live.
Good thing, yeah.
And we've been going through all the normal channels. We've been going through redevelopment agency. We've been going through park district. We've been going through the county. We've been going to town hall meetings. And We haven't gotten anywhere, so now we've camped out.
As a protest.
And we're in the middle, we're in 10 days right now.
So you're camping out as a protest?
We're camping out, not exactly as a protest. The protest is secondary. What we've actually done is raise people's standard of living. And we're doing it out of necessity because it's an emergency. We've had two homeless people die within mm-hmm. the last 3 weeks.
Uh-huh.
And everybody's, we're doing it for safety. We're doing it because we're camped where there's a bathroom. We're doing it because people can have a tent rather than hiding in the bushes. We're doing it because we have a camping stove and we can make food. And where there's a central location where people can bring food to us. And we're still there.
Well, this is a movement now, the reemergence of what used to be called Hoovervilles around the country. And a lot of them are being harassed. Are you being harassed in the site where you're in?
Actually, we have had complaints from the Park District because we are on Park District property. The Park District has complained to the police. At this present time, the police have been actually pretty cooperative with us, although they say that doomsday is coming soon.
No, okay.
We don't know how it's going to come, and we don't know when it's going to come, but mm-hmm. we're holding strong. We're all willing to go to jail for it.
When you were 12 years old and you found yourself on the street, what resources were there for you?
Well, there were no resources available when you're 12 years old, 13 years old. One of the things that is real common is that there's no employment opportunities. One of the things I've said before is you can't get a food handler's card, but you can get a dick handler's card.
It takes about 72 hours to be on the street before a child is approached by a pimp or a trick, which is a glaring problem in our community when that's the only help, quote-unquote help, that these children get is, I'll give you a room for the night if you sleep with me. So I think one of the most important things to consider are the predators that exacerbate conditions of homelessness. When we were talking about this earlier, Tony was mentioning that having a pimp is an instantaneous aspect of homelessness because they will take control of all your possessions, your clothing, your money. And so if you do attempt to leave a pimp, you will instantaneously be homeless, as well as being with a trick. If you think that you're going to get shelter by submitting to sex by this guy, oftentimes it turns out, well, he's got other plans and you end up being with this guy, and who knows who else he brings into his house for days and often weeks on end. Crack houses are a particular danger for women to get sucked into a sexual slavery experience where they can't get out. They can't get out of the house, and they're being used, forced into prostitution.
When I was 12 and a half years old, I left my biological family. I got on a bus with less than $13 of my sister's babysitting money. I went into Seattle on a bus, and I slept in a Greyhound station in the bathroom for the first 2.5 days. I was too afraid to leave. And on the third day when I left, I was hungry. I hit the streets, and I was immediately hit on by an adult male. So that really backs that 72-hour statistic that Patricia's talking about.
Dale from Humboldt, are you there?
Oh, I'm here.
Oh, great. Well, thanks for hanging on, Dale. Welcome to the Homelessness Marathon. What's on your mind?
Thanks for helping me. I'd like to discuss men made homeless through divorce court, especially in Washington State, Snohomish County. Here's the story, and it's the truth. Are you ready? I was homeless for 6 months. I'm a middle-class white male, and in March of 97, I filed for divorce. In one court hearing, where I tried to get custody of my daughter, whose well-being is still in jeopardy, I lost my house, my savings, my 401k plan, my office, and part of my fatherhood. Mm. I was homeless for 6 months, and thankfully, a very good friend of mine allowed me to live in his office and work because I was self-employed. Unfortunately, there was no shower there. I bathed out of 3 5-gallon buckets daily. I viewed it as a geologic field trip for 5 months because that's what I do as a job. I wrote, I fought back, and if I had had no education, I would have crumbled. There's no resources for men who have rightfully filed for divorce and custody of their children in Washington State, Snohomish County District Court Number 5.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dale, there's no resources, unfortunately,
no
for many,
for men.
Many kinds of people,
there
unfortunately.
There are no resources for men. And let me finish. I rebuilt. I'm happy. But I would not wish this and the homelessness that I experienced on anybody, even my worst enemy. And the only reason I came out of homelessness and didn't lose my sanity was because I had an education and I was patient.
We have a gentleman standing at the microphone. What's your first name, sir?
My name's Joker.
Okay, Joker, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon. What's on your mind?
Just to say a few things about Sisters. Sisters is giving me kind of like a second chance to improve my life. I'm their morning dishwasher, and I sleep on the streets. Me and my fiance and a couple of my friends, we all go to Sisters, and we get treated like a human being.
Mm-hmm.
When we're out on the streets, we get treated like trash. I feel more at home at Sisters of the Road Cafe.
Now, you know, we had Dale on the phone from Humboldt before, and he was saying that what got him through it was his education. But I kind of heard in that he had a sense of himself as a worthwhile person, that his education had maybe given him that, and that he thought, well, I'm somebody who can do things. And is this really, when you're on the streets and just on the streets and you're not at Sisters, do you start to lose the sense of yourself as a worthwhile person?
It's the way you make it. I mean, you can choose to improve your life or you can choose not to.
Mm-hmm.
It's really your choice. Like, I'm choosing to do something good for myself and for my fiance, and helping Sisters at the same time. I work there, I get a meal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's more than what I can say for half of the other places I go to.
Right.
I mean, you get your respect. I mean, that's the bottom line.
Well, Choker, let me ask you this. If you were in a place, I'm not saying asking you if you've ever done this, but let's say you needed money, and you were in a store, and the cash register was open, and you knew you wouldn't get caught, would you think about stealing from someplace? And if the same cash register was open at Sisters, would you feel differently about stealing from Sisters?
Being an ex-thief, yeah, I would, but I wouldn't steal from Sisters.
Yeah, I was homeless when I was 18 years old for a few weeks. But I am a white woman with blonde hair, and it was really easy. I could get whatever I wanted. People weren't afraid of me. It wasn't that hard. But that's not everybody's experience in any way.
What is it you are looking at that might make you think that there has been an impact on hunger in New York from those 911 attacks?
Well, we actually did a survey of the more than 1,000 soup kitchens and food pantries in New York City, and 71% of those agencies who responded said they had an increase in hungry people since September 11th. But it's also critical to point out that our previous survey showed there had been increasing hunger in New York City for years previous to September 11th. So our estimate is that in 2001, more than 300,000 people at some point were turned away from soup kitchens and food pantries in New York City because those agencies either temporarily or for a longer period of time actually ran out of food.
Actually, I'd like to echo what Joel said. I mean, what we've seen in New York City has been an enormous rise in homelessness in the past year, but really it's something that has been a trend for the last 3 years at least. In 1998, there were 21,000 people sleeping in New York City shelters each night, and at the end of this past year, there were more than 30,000 people sleeping in New York City shelters each night.
You call yourself nobody,
mm-hmm.
You're somebody.
Yeah, well, thank you, Carl. Are you a homeless person, Carl?
I'm in an SRO at this point.
Well, I'm glad you have some housing, Carl. You want to tell people a little bit about your story?
Sure. I was in a large family in the Midwest, and family separated, and I was taken to my father's brother's place, where there I was abused. There was emotional, physical, and sexual abuse there. It was by my aunt. And at the year 10, my father left, so I had nobody to look up to. At the age of 12, I had a motorcycle accident, which I gained brain damage and spinal damage from it. So my school grades start falling down, and I started hanging around with people smoking, drinking, and doing pot. I later on, at the age of 16, I wandered the downtown streets of Broadway here in Portland, dealing drugs and using drugs. And at that time, I ended up in a flop house where I got raped by a man in the flop house there. A year later, I ended up in the military because I wanted to help my mother keep the pressure off my mother because she was raising five kids on welfare.
So you were hoping to send a check home?
Yes. And when I was in my early teens, I used to work. Even though the child labor law didn't allow it, I was working under the table so I could bring home money so I could have school clothes and such like that. My addiction came in the military. A year after the rape by the gentleman in Portland. You see, I forget.
What year are we talking about that you were in the military?
Pardon?
What year are we talking about?
71, 72.
Were you in Vietnam?
I was in the military during Vietnam, but I was not in now.
Mm-hmm.
I witnessed a guy, a friend of mine, in a military police that I was attached to, eat a bullet. I've never seen a man die before. So all these things that happened to me, the traumas, whether it be physical, emotional, spiritual, or sexual, had built up where I had these walls. And I didn't know how to react in an emotional situation. And a lot of men out there, back in the time when I was abused, there were no programs for abusers so they could get help themselves. So most of these things happened in families behind closed doors.
Are you saying that all of these traumas in some way directly led to your homelessness?
Yes, they did, because I never knew how to react to an emotional situation. I was a working poor most of my life. I was in the military 71, 72. Later on, I got into the National Guard for 10 years. And I was living on that guard check.
Well, hang on a second, Carl.
Sure.
Let me toss this to Patrick Marquis from the Coalition for the Homeless in New York City. You know, Carl can't be the only person in the country, Patrick, who's had a lot of trauma. And are there people like Carl, who were in New York City when the attacks occurred and the softening economy there, who maybe could have coped in the good times and were doing okay when things were going well, and they're just marginal enough, this pushed them over the edge? Is this the kind of person who would have been vulnerable in New York City?
I think that's true, but again, I think the story that the caller's telling is really a common one for a lot of adults who experience homelessness. You know, a lot of surveys have shown that there's pretty high incidence of childhood abuse, of, you know, experience of family violence. And most important, I think that a lot of that trauma leads to mental illness, which often goes untreated or undiagnosed for years. I think what we found, I'm not sure what kind of SRO the caller is living in, but what we found here in New York City, and we've seen replicated throughout the rest of the
country. Speak a little louder if you can, Patrick. Go ahead.
What we've seen replicated throughout the rest of the country is that supportive housing where folks are provided with a place to live, but there are also support services, is the key to solving homelessness for folks who have had that kind of childhood or adult trauma. You know, particularly I'm thinking of the many homeless veterans that we see here in New York, veterans of Vietnam or of the Gulf War, who have PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder, or other ailments. And what we found is that supportive housing with those kinds of crucial support services has really been the successful solution to homelessness. Unfortunately, what we've seen is cutbacks in those programs. And here in New York City, where we actually saw a reduction in homelessness in the early 1990s because of some really key investments in that kind of supportive housing, because of cutbacks in recent years, we're actually beginning to see more and more folks with mental illness turning up on the streets and residing in shelters.
Hmm. Carl, can you tell us something about your situation today?
Yes, I'm glad to say that I've been clean and sober from drugs and alcohol for over 10 years.
You know, I went to Cornell. I had a decent job, decent-paying job by any standards, a high-paying job by Ithaca standards. I was in a situation where my employer owed me money. Anyhow, my house burnt down, and I had no insurance. I lost everything, and for the first time in my life, I had applied for and I received public assistance, and I became, you know, legally, technically, officially homeless, and I was that way for several months, and it was a real trip, and I think I really became I became a thorn in the side of a lot of the you know, I saw how you're treated when that happens. You know, you do completely, you're stripped of your dignity.
I'm going to say that I'm 58-year-old, former housewife, former paralegal and newspaper reporter, and in about 3 days I am going to become homeless, much as I've tried to stave it off. And I've been homeless before, particularly in the last 11 years. And although I was born and raised in Portland, I've traveled all over the United States extensively, so I consider myself more a citizen of the country than of Portland. But the reason I'm going to become homeless in a few days is that I'm facing eviction from a little office that I have been staying in for a couple of years at only $165 a month. And this is something that people don't realize. This is probably the same situation in most major cities, but in Portland, there is a living code, a city code, that disallows making an office into a dwelling. Although we can start a business in our home, we can't have a home in our business.
Mm-hmm.
And so as soon as the owner of the building found that I was also at times sleeping there at night, I was served an eviction notice. And I know that there is nowhere that you can find any kind of a dwelling for only $165 a month.
Patricia, people we'll wonder about this, though, because you're a woman who's saying you have skills, you've been a reporter, you've done
yes,
all
sir.
Of these things, and your only problem is that your rent is going up? I mean,
no, it's not that the rent is going up. It's that it's an office space that I've been using as a dwelling, and that's not allowed here.
But I mean, is you're losing that space,
I'm
unfortunately.
I'm going to lose it because I can't live in it,
and
I have nowhere else to live.
To replace it, it would cost more money than
hundreds
what you're paying.
Hundreds of dollars a month to rent even a one-room apartment.
And can't you go, I'm not saying this like you should, but I think people want to understand, can you go, what happens if you go to the social services department and you say, look, I've got a history, I've been working, I've been domiciled, and I'm a responsible person. My only problem is they're not letting me stay there anymore. Have you got any help for me? What happens when you go and
what
say
happens,
that?
For instance, this is a national organization, St. Vincent de Paul Society. They have many chapters here. I went to St. Vincent de Paul Society, and I won't tell you the hoops I went through to finally get an appointment and sit at someone's desk, only to have them call the director of SV on the telephone, who spoke to me in a very patronizing, hateful manner and explained to me that they could not give me rental assistance, although they had the money, to pay that month's rent because I was living illegally and they weren't going to do an illegal act.
Are you in Portland?
Yes.
There's another outfit called Street Roots.
Yeah, Street Roots is sponsoring this marathon.
In fact, let me tell you something about my situation in that I don't fit the majority of the programs that are set up, and there are so many everywhere, to help someone in my situation because I don't have any addictions and I don't have mental illness, and I appear to have good job skills. However, I am 58 years old, and I had a stroke 2 years ago, so I'm not quite 100% as I once was. I cannot go back to being the paralegal I once was. I don't do computers and didn't need that when I worked in that capacity. Mm-hmm. I'm losing my vision, and I have osteoporosis. I do want to say that I have a pull-out section from the December issue of Street Roots in my hand. And let me show you what one of the problems is for a person like me. They've got a pull-out section several pages long that lists a number of resources for all kinds of needs, and they're categorized under subheadings, including housing, employment assistance,
right,
food, meals, groceries, etc. Under the category of shelters, they have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Oh, see, a couple of pages of shelters, and they're broken down into families, men, women. Under women, every single shelter that I might access is closed to me because first one I see is for women and children fleeing domestic violence. The next one is women coming out of jail. The next one is for chronic mental illness. The next one is for HIV-positive persons. The next one is men only. Then I've got one, homeless women with children. Women with children fleeing domestic violence. Parolees in jeopardy is the next one. Do you get my point about the shelters?
I got your point, but they have to have an emergency service there for people who don't have any of those problems, man.
Sir, what they have here is about 50% more need has cropped up in the last four months.
And
50% less in donations. Because I might add, a few months back, I recall when our illustrious mayor, Vera Katz, took a coalition of about 999 people on first-class flight to New York City to spend in the highest-priced stores you have, like Saks Fifth Avenue and Lord and Taylor and so on. And they got on National Public Radio one morning when I was listening to about five of them laughing and cutting up and having such a good time that week. And one of the members of the party said, God, I spent $25 on a bowl of oatmeal this morning.
Like that was funny. And you were there?
And what I want to do is put out a challenge right now. As long as I'm on the air nationally, I want to challenge Mayor Katz and challenge all 999 of her colleagues and cohorts who made this expensive trip to look right here in your own city, in your own community, and I'm challenging you to put every single dollar that you spend in New York City now, another dollar matching it, into the homeless and the poorest of the poor in your community to support your poor.
Patricia, I want to thank you very much for sharing this story. I want to ask you, and I don't mean to be asking you what sounds like a stupid question. I just want to bring this point out. Because people are going to be listening around the country, and they're going to be saying, okay, you're an articulate person, you're clearly a passionate and a motivated person, and boy, a lot of people, I'm 52, can identify with what it means to be getting older in the labor market, and they're going to be just in disbelief. They're going to be saying, what? You're saying that a person who can speak well, a person who's been housed, a person who's worked, you're saying there's
nothing?
A person
who's been a military wife for the last several years that is a full-time, moving frequently military wife,
and you're
not in the job market since 1990.
And they're going to say incredulously, because they want to believe otherwise, they're going to say, are you telling me there's really just nothing for you here?
Yes, I'm telling you that. And I can tell you how I've survived. And it takes sheer guts, and it takes just continually pushing, because as soon as you enter this category called homelessness, as soon as you go to the agencies, I don't care who they are, I don't care if they have a Christian Judeo name, the staff that you meet with already has drawn a curtain across your personhood, and in their eyes, you are one of these things. You are either lying because you're so articulate and don't really have the need, or you're so articulate that you can advocate for yourself, and we all know that you cannot advocate for yourself. Let me tell you how I spent one day, just yesterday, when I needed basic
services, basic needs met in my life that all of you who have homes are able to meet in a matter of minutes. It may take me a half day to 3 days. I have no telephone, so I had to take a bus at my expense with no income across the river, across town to a Kinko's Copy Center in Northwest Portland, miles away, to use the phone for about an hour, and in between give it up because there's a sign in front of that phone that says calls limited to 5 minutes. And if I'm looking for work and using a phone such as that one for customer service, no one can call me back. It does not ring back. It has no phone number. Pay phones are 50 cents a call. And the day before yesterday, using a pay phone in our cold weather, I spent $7 very quickly making job calls, pursuing ads out of the newspaper, and got nowhere. Because when you dial that number, you don't reach the hiring person. You reach an answering machine, which then swallows your money. Or you reach a receptionist or a secretary, and you just get nowhere. You know, and I've panhandled to get that money for those phone calls. If I need a bath, it may take me a full day of wheeling and dealing to go somewhere and have someone allow me to have a bath or a shower or pay for one or, very wily way, find a bathroom attached to a restaurant that has a door you can lock that takes only one customer at a time and try to use the sink and get the hell out of there within a few minutes before anyone starts banging on the door because I'm in there too long. I'm supposed to have become homeless today, so instead I locked the place up. They're not going to bust the door down. And I came down here to stay out of the way. Then I'm going to call up the owner and I'm going to beg to have until Saturday. What I need is a truck. I have my household goods in that office space, clear up to the ceiling, all boxed up. I've already sold off what I could, more than I should have and more than I wanted to. Part of it is what I inherited from my mother's death last year. And the reason that I have become homeless in the first place is what the systems helped by my family did when my mother died, because as many grown, middle-aged children today are finding out, who go into your family home or your parents' home and try to care for an ailing, frail, elderly parent without a salary and without taking money from that parent because you feel that you want to do it and should do it for free, you may find yourself jobless at the end when that person dies.
Somehow or another, and I've got to ascribe it to the Lord God because I'm Jewish. I came back here to Arkansas, and a lady that I'd known for years stayed on her place. When I come home from the railroads, I'm a street musician. And I go all over the country, and I come home and rest a few months here. She was put in a nursing home, and I'm taking care of her property. It's just a blessing, which gives me a chance. I have a computer, I have ham radio equipment and all this. But there is no answer. Years of urban renewal from 1966 and onward, with my little wife and I, were just teenagers, we watched them tearing down the main parts of downtown Oklahoma City, Milwaukee, and everywhere. They just tearing down all these old places. That's where all the poor folks lived. Right here in Hot Springs, Arkansas, with me and my wife first got married in January of 1969, we lived in a two-room apartment for $7 a week, and I worked as a dishwasher at a Jewish restaurant, and I made enough to live, and we had enough to do fine. Why is it now you can't rent nothing in Hot Springs less than $375 to $400 a month? And when you do rent something that cheap, you do not want to live there. Because a drug addiction and things like that. That's what drove me out to being homeless.